I'm Ariel Baska, former teacher, polyglot, super nerd, and host of Ride the Omnibus, a pop culture podcast that's here to take you on a journey through the old and new. Our panel of creators and educators is here to go off-road and guide you onto detours across history and culture to give you a different perspective on the works that make our wheels go round. This is a special week for us. We're celebrating great works of Black horror and what they have to give us in this time of unrest and uncertainty. We're kicking off with a conversation about horror noir, a history of Black horror. The next two episodes this week will discuss two other masterworks of horror, Tales from the Hood and Us. But today I'd like to welcome to the show our two guests, Sean Gleason and Alex Stevens. Welcome to the show. I'm so glad to have you guys here talking about Black horror in this horrific moment that we are living through right now. Sean, would you care to introduce yourself to our listeners?
No, I wouldn't.
Oh, okay.
Hi, my name is Sean Gleason. I am a librarian and also a major horror fan, which I guess is why I'm on here. I've done a bunch of horror-related panels at conventions. Looking forward to talking about this because it's a very interesting documentary on a topic that I didn't really know much about. So,
okay, very cool. And Alex,
My name's Alex Stevens. I've been a fan of sci-fi, fantasy, and horror like as long as I can remember. Not super exciting. I don't have any professional connections to those genres. It's just that I've always been a fan, and I've always gravitated to those types of films and movies, and so I thought watching this documentary was pretty interesting, and I was willing to join the conversation.
Awesome. Well, we're glad to have you. One thing that I really would like to know, though, in this particular moment, because I haven't seen either of you for quite some time now in the flesh, how are you doing in this pandemic time of protests, of all manner of hell breaking loose on Earth? When we talk about both this period in American history, I think we're always going to remember COVID-19, but we're also going to remember what's been happening with the Black Lives Matter movement too. And I think those two things are going to go hand in hand. So I wondered if you had any thoughts about kind of how you've been doing and processing this in this moment, Sean?
Let's see. I have been living in severe anxiety, but that's my usual state anyways. But this whole pandemic, with my job, I haven't been able to work or anything. So I've just been sitting around at home, generally huddled in a corner, hoping that viruses don't get me. But it's a very disturbing time. And just the thought that probably by the end of the month, I'm going to be back out in the world, returning to work in the midst of all this is pretty panic inducing. Crazy right now.
Yeah. And Alex, how about you?
So I think at the beginning of this, if you had asked me at the beginning of the year in 2020 on my 2020 bingo card, if I thought I'd be sitting at home working from home during a global pandemic and watching what we see on TV every day, I would have not in my wildest dreams picked pandemic. Police brutality and focus on Black lives, I'm not that surprised about. It's something that I feel like seeing what's going on that I just took for granted. Like, and you're going to talk about all these movies. And one of the things that I'm going to throw out there is that in a lot of these movies, there's always that like knowing nod, like, you know, the ones made by the Black directors and writers, like there's always this knowing nod to like the things that we experience. And these are the movies I grew up watching. So to me, I was just like, when I see George Floyd on TV, and it breaks my heart because, you know, I feel like that's like my dad. That looks like my dad, my brother, my cousins. What is this? But at the same time, it's sort of like, it shocks me that people didn't know about this before, and suddenly everyone's like, oh my gosh, we've got to get our t-shirts and our signs. And like, you know, it's the neighborhood I live in is predominantly white, but it's fairly diverse. But a lot of my neighbors, suddenly it's all the signs are up and everyone's like, you know, it's everyone's friendly, and that's great. But it's just sort of a interesting in the times. I don't think we would have been here at this moment huddling in our houses afraid of a pandemic. But the fact that suddenly everyone else is clued into like what I've known my whole life is just sort of like, it's jarring, but it's in a way it's somewhat comforting, but in light of the whole situation, frightening, because it's just sort of like, finally people get it. But at the same time, like, just to like, is it enough? And where are we going to be in a year? Like, are people going to like, oh, this t-shirt's faded, let me just stick it in the back of my closet, move on to the next thing? So just sort of like, what is it really going to happen? Like, are we going to go through all this and then November 3rd, Trump's reelected, and then it's like, for what? Like, and the fact that he could have been reelected, I mean, the fact that prior to this, his chance of reelection was actually pretty good, that terrifies me. The fact that it took a pandemic and nationwide protests to move the needle on his presidency. But yeah,
I mean, it's kind of overwhelming to think about, and also to think about the fact that it took a pandemic and people literally being stuck at home to actually see the truth of what's been going on for so long. And, you know, I mean, I've seen people out there with signs saying things like, I'm sorry, I'm late, I had a lot to learn, you know, and I think there are a lot of people who have that attitude. But at the same time, I'm sure it has to be very frustrating to see a lot of people with the attitude of, oh yeah, now it's an issue for our times. Yeah. But
and of course the question is, you know, how long will it be? Like, will people remember all this? Or will we just go back to saying, well, everything's done, we're good in like a few months?
Yeah.
Because that's, I don't know, people kind of tend to forget things, important things like that, in a pretty quick manner. So I don't know. Will it last, I guess, is the question.
That's an important question. And American memories can be very, very short. Mm-hmm. But the nice thing, as a friend of mine pointed out recently, is that life is short, but art is long. And horror movies, I think, are another important form of art. So I want to kind of talk about horror noir as a film. And this particular film is significant for a lot of reasons. It was actually directed by two women, Danielle Burroughs and Ashley Blackwell, based on a book by Robin Means Coleman. This film does a great job of representing a lot of different voices from across the spectrum, at least from major talents who are still alive, from the writers, directors, and actors, and film scholars. How did you guys feel about the people who were chosen to comment in the film?
Well, I mean, they definitely had a good selection of people, and definitely, you know, some people who you'd expect to see. Like, you know, having Tony Todd and Keith David and people like that, you know, you definitely expect to see them. While there are other people like the guy from Nightmare on Elm Street Part 3, somebody who, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I think that they had a good selection.
I thought they did a good job of getting a cross-section of people that you'd be familiar with. Like, you know, they had Jordan Peele and Tony Todd that you would know. Okay, I know those names. But then there's these people who, at first I was like, why are these people on screen? Why? But, you know, they're the people who were carrying the conversation on now. So it made sense. And it was good to hear their voices. And I think it highlighted how much, you know, Hollywood is a man's world. Mm-hmm. And that the women tended to be much younger or academic in their approach. Like, so I thought that was an interesting spread of people, like the people who grew up watching these movies, you know, would have seen them on like TBS or TNT or whatever, and the people who would have gone to the theater to see them. And that's sort of a good mix of how these movies have lasted.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point, sort of the generationality, how old you are when you are able to see these films and how you respond to them certainly changes the conversation significantly. In general, the way that I saw the themes as broken down in the film was firstly, Black horror as Black history. The atrocities committed by the Ku Klux Klan and the lynchings in the South and slavery, all of these horrific things that happened to Black bodies for so long were to a large extent mirrored in horror. And they actually start kind of characterizing the different periods of horror films and or just film in general, starting with Birth of a Nation. The example of the white man in blackface, who is the first example of a Black man on film that they talk about.
You know, I saw Birth of a Nation when I was in high school. There's another student in my class. Mm-hmm. He brought this, it was a VHS tape to school because we're that old. And he brought it to school and he said to the teacher, you know, I think we should watch this. You know, my dad says this is a great movie. It's a classic. And the teacher looked at him and said, you know what? Yeah, we are going to watch it and we're going to have a serious discussion. And my parents originally didn't want me to watch the film. They thought it was going to be really, really upsetting. And my mom decided to let me watch it. So I went to school that day and everyone in 11th grade U.S. history watched it. And the thing I remember taking away about this film, and at the school I went to, I was one of like very few students of color, usually the only one in my class. We were sitting here watching this film about A Birth of a Nation, and then we were having this discussion afterwards, you know, over the rest of that week, and my classmates were thinking, this movie's goofy, and it's weird, and it's kind of strange, and I'm sitting there just cringing about the fact that the character Gus is there in blackface, and that he, you know, it's not, to me, the movie wasn't so much about, my takeaway wasn't that Black culture was deviant, but that, like the commentator said, that Black people, we're the monster. Mm-hmm. And that the interesting part about it is that by casting a white actor to play Gus in blackface, it's very clear, at least to me, that they couldn't trust an actual Black person to depict a Black person as the monster that the filmmakers wanted. Mm-hmm. Either, I'm sure there's, you know, I don't know the complete history of the film, but the fact that they chose to go with an actor in blackface, something that had fallen out of favor, you know, by that point as a medium, sort of just struck me as very interesting. And then the scenes where you have like a Black picnic and watch people dance and they film that, those seems like those normal scenes of life depicted as deviant.
Yeah.
Was just sort of what was like, you know, like, okay, what is this movie trying to say? And I was just like, this is a terrible, you know, it's a terrible movie, but it's just sort of like this idea that Black people being seen as you know, the monster, mm-hmm. that, you know, he's there to violate that, the white girl. And there's just sort of, it was just such an awkward situation to be in that I always remember that. The teacher was great, I thought. She really tried to have a serious conversation about it, which, you know, you can argue whether or not that's possible with a room full of 17-year-olds. But she kind of approached the film as like, yes, this is a part of U.S. film history. And she didn't come out and say, oh, this is the worst movie ever. She just said, this is a part of U.S. film history. We're going to watch it. We're going to talk about the cultural ideas that are presented. And we talked a lot about, you know, why it was offensive now and why people back then would have said, oh, yeah, of course, Gus is sitting in Congress with his feet on the desk eating fried chicken and watermelon. But my classmates, they could sit there and watch this movie and go, yes, this is a terrible depiction of Black people. This is horrible. And then they could make this jump. This is like, you know, this is like the late 90s from, this is a terrible depiction to, but hey, you know, like Black kids are taking my spot. Like, yeah, that movie sucks. But hey, the real victim here is me who's not going to get to go to my top school choice because some minority child is going to take my pre-selected slot. Just that, like, that whole incident, I was like, oh my God, really? We're back to that now. When I look back on it, I'm happy the teacher took the time and was willing to go out there. Because, you know, I feel like in today's environment, most high school teachers wouldn't dare.
Yeah.
It's an important part of film history, and it's good that, like, I think horror noir discuss it in a way that it can be digested and analyzed, you know, especially in light of the advances we've made in representation in Hollywood.
And then when we look at the films that come after that point, the point that they make in horror noir is that between the 30s and the 60s, that you don't see very many black people in horror movies, but that they are implicit in the monsters like King Kong and Creature from the Black Lagoon. How did you guys react to that idea?
It's something that I had never heard or thought about before with those movies, so I found it interesting.
I've actually specifically heard of both of those movies referenced in that way before, but I honestly can't remember where I heard that. But I know I've heard people discussing King Kong as the black man trying to rape the white woman, the whole jungle theme. And I do remember people talking specifically about the race implications of Creature from the Black Lagoon because you have all of the Latin American men on the boat, and then you have this creature who's very specifically other from them as well. And again, there's that sort of pas de deux scene where it's very sexual between the woman who's swimming and then the creature who's swimming below her. And it's like there's always this idea of the black male is a sexual threat in some way in both of those movies. And I really wish I could remember where I've heard this theory before, but it wasn't first introduced in horror noir for me. But I don't know. Alex, do you have thoughts on this one?
I do. These are just things that when I was a kid, when these movies popped up on, you know, cable TV and syndication, we talked about. I mean, my mom was a child of the 50s and 60s, and she grew up watching these movies. So, you know, we'd watch them together when I was a kid, and we would talk about those kind of ideas when I got older. You know, I remember singing King Kong as a kid and thinking, you know, why are these tribesmen on this island or whatever? Why do they look the way they do, and why are they acting the way they do? And you know, my mom and my dad saying, like, let's talk about the representation you're seeing here, and like, what does this really symbolize? And I know that it's come up other places too, and it's the same with the Black Lagoon. Like, what is this shorthand for? What are you seeing? And then, like, I feel like as a black person, when you kind of become like overly sensitized to some of those things. Like you start, but then you start like, well, when you watch it, do you think the filmmaker actually intended it to be received that way? Or like, was this a subconscious thing in the back of their own minds, like this representation? And then when you mentioned King Kong, it made me have another thought. I have two small kids, and one of the book series that we've read with our kids is Curious George. And, you know, coming back to that as an adult with adult eyes, I opened it, and the very first thing I think is, Curious George is really, you know, he's a monkey, but he's really a little black boy. And, you know, like, I think there is some story about, sure enough, how like they wanted to portray a little black boy, and they thought that a monkey might be more acceptable to a broader audience. And I feel like that, like, I wonder now, is that really what was happening with King Kong? Did they say, oh yes, we could have had this giant ape of a man, black man character, but an actual ape, maybe that would have been more acceptable for the story. But everyone of the time would have known on some level that that's the shorthand that's being used.
Some part of me, I think, always assumed that it was on a literal level with King Kong, but not necessarily with Creature from the Black Lagoon. But then when they were pointing out the imagery in horror noir, I was like, oh my God, why was I not actually more aware of this? But
Yeah, I definitely never thought of or saw that in those movies before, but now I don't think I'll be able to see those movies the same way.
Yeah.
Now, and that's good.
Yeah, it is good. And I think it's really important to be able to kind of revisit these films that we largely see as classics and to view them in a different historical context. And then they spend a lot of time getting into one of the most seminal moments in Black American horror, which is 1968's Night of the Living Dead. And I am by no means an expert on this film, anywhere near as much as Mr. Sean Gleason over there. And so I want him to talk about this a little bit. But like, the thing that got me in horror noir was the constant discussion of how Dwayne Jones was just the best actor to show up on the day, and that that was why he was cast, and that was the justification George Romero gave, and so forth. I really have a hard time believing that.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, it's because it just... It would be a very, very different movie that wouldn't really have the same meaning if you didn't have the Black man as your hero in that movie. It wouldn't be the same movie. So it's kind of difficult to imagine that, you know, he just happened to cast this guy because he was the best person there. It would change the movie and its meaning completely.
I get the feeling there's probably a lot more to the backstory. You know, it's probably something. So you know what? Maybe we can change the endings. Because, you know, when you read about those old movies, I feel like you hear all the time that people, movies in general, you find that one person and suddenly everything ripples out and changes. But I'm just so happy that that's something that was able to happen. It changed the discussion.
Completely changed the discussion. And when you have lines like, I'm the boss up here, you may be the boss down there, I'm the boss up here. I mean, that seems very explicitly a reference to slavery. And then you have the ending of the film that seems like a very explicit reference to lynching mobs. I mean, there are so many different elements of it that you can talk about. Like, growing up, did you guys encounter this film?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I was watching horror movies as long as I can remember. Mm. So George Romero, in at least his first few zombie movies, they're really saying something. Like, you know, Dawn of the Dead takes place in a mall. It's a lot to say about commercialism, etc. While this one clearly has a lot to say about racism. So I don't really believe Romero when he says that the role that Dwayne Jones played was written specifically for a Black man.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible that's what he had to tell the studio, but I really don't for a second believe that it wasn't his intention all along.
Oh, yeah, no. The movie wouldn't be the same.
I mean, in all those news clips that you have interspersed throughout mm-hmm. that are so, you know, explicitly connective tissue.
You know, I liked the part of the documentary where they talked about him racing back. You know, he's driving back to New York with the film and, you know, King gets killed. And like, I guess in my mind, I almost wonder if then he goes, you know what, while I'm editing this, maybe I can make a different movie. Like, I happen to have walked into this great Black actor, I have him here, we filmed this great movie, now I can really, like, I can do more than just move the needle a little bit by having a Black actor in this role and having changed my script. But now that on the death of Dr. King, I can now go forward and push it a little bit more. Like, my memories of this movie, I have an uncle, he's passed away now, but I spent the summer with him and my grandmother up in New York, and he had an extensive library of horror movies, and especially these Blaxploitation films that you're going to get into next. And I remember him showing me this movie and saying, oh, you like horror movies? You've got to see this one. And, you know, leaving me with it and you know, he went to work, and I watched it and thinking like, oh wow, like, and then it was interesting to see in the documentary all those scenes and all those things that, you know, I saw this movie like last time I think I was like 12, and then to be reminded of all these different things that, like I said, you don't see when you're a kid, but you see when you're an adult, and I thought that was great. It makes me want to go back and watch it again.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that makes me really think that this wasn't an accident is knowing a bit about George Romero's history, knowing that, you know, his first job was working with Mr. Rogers. Yeah, I could see why he would want to try to teach things and change things through this horror movie that he's making. And so, yeah, that kind of makes me, gives me the idea that it probably wasn't just a lucky accident and confluence of events. I think that he went into this socially conscious with the idea of what he wanted to make. It's very possible that all this came together and, you know, he ended up making the movie that he did, but I'm not sure if that... I don't quite believe that's what happened.
Well, I think the editing of the news footage in, I think that's a probable thing that could have been inserted after the fact. So I like Alex's point there on that, because I think the way that historical events help you push the narrative is an important thing to remember. Mm-hmm. And then you have in the 70s, which, you know, you go from Dwayne Jones, powerful, handsome black man, taking out the zombies, to blaxploitation films, which are largely very cheap budgets. You have a lot of the imagery that's pretty tawdry for the most part. But then you have some significant exceptions that horror noir mentions in there. And they at least do a good job of depicting positive characteristics of black people in films like Blackula, Ganja and Hess, and Sugar Hill. Alex, for you growing up, what was your take on blaxploitation as a genre?
Well, you know, when I was a kid, it was just funny.
Yeah.
This is something, you know, like I said, like, I think when I was a kid, you know, we had cable. These movies would be on TBS or TNT, I think on AMC during Black History Month, because, you know, why not? I imagine they're fairly inexpensive to air on TV. My uncle had, like, a pretty vast collection of them. But I just remember, like, you know, for a kid in the 90s watching these, it's just, like, it's goofy looking. It's afros. It's, like you said, like, the whole pimps and the shoes, and it just all looks ridiculous. And so I had to be a bit older, you know, middle school, high school, when I finally, I'm looking at these movies and I'm going, what is this? And what are we trying to say here? I often wondered why it was that these black characters that actually did things and had interesting lives and lived in a black world, you know, which was different from the world that I lived in, this all black world where, yes, there were powerful people, like, of all people, Blackula. Where were those movies in my time in the 90s? And they were out there in their own way. But I think for me, like, looking at the blaxploitation films of the 70s, they just sort of seemed like the foundation of this separate black film world. And it just sort of struck me as odd as that the ones that made it to network TV were these corny blaxploitation films. But, you know, for me, they were ones that, like, I saw, I thought they were funny because they were very silly. And it wasn't until I was much older that I saw, oh, yeah, Blackula is a powerful guy. Like, he actually, there's something more to it. But for the most part, it was just, like, very comical. The documentary was interesting because I started to think about them more and, like, what the films were trying to say, not just how hilarious the costumes were.
Mm. Well, you know, I hadn't seen any of those movies until this past week after watching this documentary.
I'm shocked. Really?
I've seen a lot of 70s exploitation movies, but I'm not overly familiar with the blaxploitation subgenre of that. But yeah, so because I just kind of expected, you know, say Blackula, based on the name, to just be sort of, you know, silly, cheap, etc. And then, you know, I watched this documentary and thought, huh, I actually should watch this movie. And I watched it and absolutely loved it. Blackula is a great movie.
It is. It genuinely is.
Despite its silly name, Blackula is a great movie. A lot better than I ever thought it could be, and a lot different than I ever thought it would be as well. So
that goes back to my earlier point. Like, you just, I feel like I always took those things for granted, that like, that those were just movies that existed and they were out there, and I didn't know that prior to the 70s we just didn't have those kind of movies. Like,
yeah. There's also another film that they give a shout out to that I want to give a shout out to, which is Ganja and Hess, which is a very arty film. Have you seen this, Alex?
No, I saw the clips in the documentary and I had the same thought. I was like, wow, that looks very art house.
It's amazing. It actually stars Dwayne Jones, the same man who is the lead in Night of the Living Dead. It's so specifically about the aesthetic. And I think a lot of people have rejected it because of certain things it has, like full frontal male nudity, which, you know, back then, that was very much not the thing. But the film is gorgeous to watch. It's stunning. It's slow. But it's an unusual brand of horror that you don't really see until really the early 2000s. It can also be thoughtful and reflective too. And I just want to make sure everybody remembers that there's more than just comedy there. So, which Alex was definitely getting at. So then we have the 80s. Woohoo! And we have black people as basically those red shirts from Star Trek. Yay. The black person who's being used to prove that the opponent is formidable in some way. And it's really...
Ugh. Yeah, when it got to that bit, I mean, the first thing that I thought of was probably my favorite scene in the movie, but still Friday the 13th Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan. Where, you know, you have Jason and that boxer guy up on the roof. And, you know, he's punching Jason and, you know, getting tired. And then Jason just punches his head off. It's a funny, hilarious scene. But, yeah, it's the sort of, you know, sacrificial guy showing how tough Jason is.
Mm-hmm. So, like, we were all children of the 80s. What was the first contemporary image of a black person that you saw in the 80s in horror? I'm just curious. I want to know.
For me, I think when they showed the guy from Nightmare on Elm Street 3, that just brought back so many memories of being a kid. I remember watching that one, and I think they mentioned The Thing, right? The one guy they were talking to from The Thing.
Yeah.
And I remember watching, and like you said, like there's this idea of like the sacrificial Negro, and there was somewhere like when I was like around 11, 12, I remember watching some stand-up comedian on like, I'm going to say Comedy Central or something, and he had said something along the lines of, he was a black comedian, and he said, you know, there's a reason why you don't see that many black people in horror movies. It's because we're too smart. It's only the dumb ones who stick around. Everyone else is like, I'm getting the fuck out of here. And, you know, we leave, you know, Karen or Stacy or Allison, you know, to do her stupid shit. And we, you know, GTFO, we get out and just leave them. And I just thought, yeah, that makes sense. Like, that's why we're not representing these movies. But, like, there's that idea of the whole tokenism where, you know, it's the 80s. People are aware, so you've got to have one. So you've got the guy from Nightmare on Elm Street. You had Miguel Nunez Jr. I remember him in the movie he was in and other things. And they're there and they're cool. They're, you know, because black people, we're cool and we're fun and they're cool. And then, you know, oh, now they get him and you root for that guy because you see them. You say, hey, that's me being represented on screen. But then you also think, oh, but you're not going to last. You're not going to last, like, you know, through the end of this movie. And the ones that last longer, you go, wow, okay, that was progress. And then, like, I don't know if you're going to get to it later, but for me, like, when you get to the, like, 2000, 2001, and you get to Pitch Black, and
oh yeah,
that's a whole different conversation, a different type of horror. But just the idea back in the 80s, like, you don't make it, like, you're not the protagonist. Maybe you're the sidekick, you know. In a really progressive film, you're gonna make it through, but generally you're cannon fodder, and mm-hmm. your purpose is to nobly sacrifice you for some, excuse me, stupid idiot blonde chick who's gonna go traipsing through, you know, murder woods in a pair of high heels and short ass jeans, just, you know, with a sign saying "murder me," but you're gonna dive in the way so she can escape to the end where she sobs and like. Well, you know, but people who are listening probably don't know. I'm black. I'm married to a white guy. And we have conversations about race all the time. And one of the things that, like, you know, it's a current phenomenon, the Karens.
Yeah.
You know, in the media. So, like, often when, you know, watching the Karens in the media, and I'm just kind of like, again, like, you guys didn't, people didn't know about this phenomenon. And then when you see the horror movies and there's always this woman and she insist on doing the stupidest thing possible, mm-hmm. because there's always going to be these characters who are, you know, male, minority, you know, you name it, who are going to jump in the way, or the less attractive female, and she will luckily, you know, like, traipse through unharmed while she, like, you know, reads the Necronomicon aloud, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, It's pretty horrifying that is a thing that continues to persist in so many ways, both in fiction and in reality. I hope no one's actually reading the Necronomicon in reality, though. Like, if you're doing that, listeners, stop. Just
I'm doing that right now.
Sean? In the 80s, we get Reaganism. And we have the whole trope that they bring up of white suburbia, where, again, there's exclusion of black people, but there's this idea of evil bubbling up from black and brown people underneath white neighborhoods. Now, I've heard it referred to in different ways by different people who are kind of defending this idea, saying, oh, yeah, it's because people were trying to sweep racism under the rug and, like, you know, the whole idea is that whatever you try to sweep under the rug is going to come back to bite you in the ass. And so you have to portray that somehow, except they don't really portray that. You have these exclusionary systems of class that basically illustrate what redlining is in American cities and suburbs.
Yeah, I mean, the 80s was like Reaganism, capitalism run amok. I mean, all those 80s sitcoms and shows where they open up and the very first thing you see is that big colonial style house with all the windows in the front, and the people actually have, you know, these 5-bedroom mini mansions out in the suburbs, you know, nary a brown face to be found for miles. Like, that was, and the ones that do make it, oh, well, you know what, those are the good ones. It's okay. Yeah. We screened them out. They're okay. I got what they were trying to say in Horror Noir about that, you know, okay, now that we've escaped the cities and we've escaped those neighborhoods where these black and brown people are coming in, now it's the suburbs, and oh man, drats, they're still here. They're literally under our feet, bubbling up. I was like, okay, I can definitely see that. But like you said, like a lot of the biggest horror movies where they go, they're simply, we're not there. When you look at it, the movies they mention Amityville and Poltergeist, those are really family horror movies. It's not so much about, like, you know, like Elm Street and Freddy Krueger, those are groups of friends and people who come together. These are horror based on the family unit.
Mm-hmm.
The stakes change. Like, they're being terrorized and it's horrific, but they come out whole. And I kind of wonder, like, what message you know, if you dissect that, what does that say? Like you said, you remove the black and brown people from the situation, but now the horror is based on this nuclear family who largely, like, you know, they come at whole, but oh, is it that they lose their house? Like, is Amityville, the family flees the house and the house is, you know, it's there. And then, like, Poltergeist, I think they have to move.
Yeah.
You know, like, what does that mean? Does it mean the dream isn't real? You can't get away from those people? I'm just kind of curious. Like, that was, when I was watching that in the documentary, I thought about that.
You know, I'm somebody who did grow up in one of those suburbs with nary a black person to see anywhere. And I remember this was around, gosh, 2000 or so, when my parents sold that house. And the neighbors were extremely angry at them because they dared to sell their house to a black family. Yeah. Mm.
In 2000.
In 2000, yes.
Right.
I'm not that surprised, honestly.
Yeah.
I remember when I was first buying my first place, a condo, I went to go look at a particular neighborhood, a historic, storied condo complex, and my realtor, who was Hispanic, called, and the other realtor called back and said, no, you cannot come tour. And it was very much like a wait. And he's like, hey, I'm not living there. I'm just a realtor. And they said, we don't care. Whoever you're representing is probably brown. And that was sort of like that. And he called me and he said, they are refusing to show the property. I've definitely seen, and you probably have too, as you've looked at your, you know, buying your own properties, like you go out and people, at least for me, like, you go out and you're looking at the property and people come out of their houses and, oh, who's looking?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Who's looking at that house, you know? And like, whether or not, like, some people I've seen, I go on a house tour and they come out and they're very friendly. They're like, please buy this house. We would love to have you. And other people are just kind of like, oh, really? You're here. What are you kind of just looking at through their windows? And
yeah, I'm used to the latter reaction, mostly because of my cane, because it makes it clear that I have disabilities and like, oh, well, don't trip on something. You might sue me, you know. But
yeah, no, people are terrible.
Well, yeah. Okay, so on that note, I do want to say about Reaganism one thing, and that is People Under the Stairs. Which is, I have to say, the first film I ever saw that featured a black actor. And I'm so glad it was, because Brandon Quinton Adams in that film just is... He was... How old was I? I would have been 9 when that came out. And I think, you know, it was the first time I saw a horror film where there was an actual child who was there to be something other than an annoying, whiny little brat. Yeah. And, you know, and it was really amazing for me to see this stratification of, like, upstairs, downstairs, looking at America as an allegory in this Wes Craven film. And I remember, I probably didn't get all of it. I probably mostly got that, like, BDSM was really, really creepy, more than anything out of that movie when I was a kid. But it definitely stuck with me in a way I couldn't quite wrap my head around. And I don't think it was until I actually watched this with you, Sean, that I actually, like, felt I understood this film.
When I first saw it, I liked it. But, you know, I didn't really get all that stuff from it because, yeah, I was a kid and it's been years since I've seen it. But I do remember that it's a lot better than I had remembered it being from when I was a kid, just because there is a lot that's interesting there.
I mean, and especially with the white couple in it seeming to be like stand-ins for Ronald and Nancy Reagan. Position seemingly completely in opposition to everyone else in the neighborhood of any kind of color at all. And I just remember thinking as a kid that that was meaningful somehow, but I couldn't quite piece together, but it felt important. I don't know. Alex?
You know, I don't remember seeing this movie as a kid. Like, really? I very well could have seen it, but I, you know, when I was watching the clip in Horror Noir, I'm looking at it, I'm like, hey, that's the kid from Moonwalker.
Oh.
That's what, like, registers in my mind. I was like, that's like the Children of the Corn guy.
Yeah,
yeah. But I was like, man, like, I don't, if I saw this movie as a kid, I definitely, it did not have an impression on me. But I put it on my list of films to watch. But your comment about, like, sort of having, like, the Nancy and Ronald Reagan standing in the neighborhood just reminds me of sort of, like the old guard in the neighborhood. Like, you know, you have this couple or this family there, and they're considered to be very well respected. And what they think should go in the neighborhood is what happens. Like, people look to them, like, maybe they're not like the HOA leaders or whatever, but people look to them and, like, you know, they're the ones that keep everybody else in line. To go back to Shani's comment about his parents selling his house, their house, those are the people that come and say, like, to me, like, hey, you know, what are you doing? Because it's not like any one person is going to say, oh, everyone's going to tell them, oh, I'm not racist or I'm not this. But, you know, then they're going to say, oh, well, you know, if you sell to one black family or one Indian family, like, one, you know, more show up.
Like, of course, they mentioned Candyman, which is one of my favorites.
That's so important. My villains can be my heroes. He totally is. Clarence Williams III, also one of my heroes, also on there. I don't care if he's the literal devil. Still, you know.
Well, anti-heroes can be fun.
Yeah.
Totally. I mean, I remember watching Candyman as a kid. Like, you know, my parents would let me rent horror movies when they would do date nights and stuff, and I remember getting that one and being, oh, candy, like, this is gonna be, and I'm thinking, all right, but it's a horror movie. Or, like, I think one of my cousins, like, had, you know, we watched it, and I didn't think of it, like, even as a kid, I never thought of it as scary, but sort of like as a interesting look at life in a black neighborhood. Mm-hmm. That happens to also have Candyman in it. Because it's Cabrini Green instead of Suburbia. This is a haunted tower block, you know, by this Bloody Mary-esque character, you know, you say, and he shows up with the hook and everything. And I was just like, wow, okay, this is different. This is fun. And I remember liking it because there's black people in it. I was just like, oh, hey, there we are. We're on screen. And, like, enjoying it and being drawn in because of that.
Yeah, I was gonna say there's a lot that they talk in the documentary. They talk about this movie quite a bit, about how you have your first sort of black supernatural killer. And I like the line that somebody said, I don't remember who it was, but, you know, it's like, you know, the black guy can be the Freddy now. You know? But yeah, I also think that it's interesting how Jordan Peele specifically says that it's a film that he loves, but also one that's kind of problematic.
Oh, in so many ways. But
yes.
But you can't help but love it anyway.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing about it. And, like, for me specifically, it's because I grew up in Chicago. And Cabrini Green was an area I knew. I didn't see a lot of the Chicago I knew on screen anywhere in all the other films I was ever watching. And Candyman was the first film I saw that I felt represented, you know, the demographics of my city. And, you know, and then you add into it Tony Todd's amazing performance. It's just magic. But at the same time, it plays into that same trope that you see in Birth of a Nation. Mm-hmm. You know, the black man who is a sexual threat to the white woman. And
and, you know, the fact that you have this guy who, you know, is basically lynched, and yet he's haunting the poor black people instead
right,
of the
right. Instead of the white people on Lakeshore Drive, like, why would he not bother to go to the water tower? Like, really, they're just over there.
I also thought it was problematic that is this white woman is the protagonist, that she's the avatar, like she's entering in to this black neighborhood and this black world.
Yeah.
And of course she's attacked by the ghost. So you're just like, what? Why?
That also does bring in the themes of interracial conflict that they were talking about. So I could see why you would do that, but still there's a lot there. Like they say that it's clear that this came from the mind of a white person. When I think of that movie, it's always, you know, Tony Todd anyway.
Yeah, always.
That was my introduction. That was probably a lot of people's introduction to Tony Todd. I don't know how much he did before that. But, you know, I'll go and see anything that he's in. He always adds something special to a movie.
One thing that they mentioned in the documentary that Candyman makes me think of, and they did mention this, was a vampire in Brooklyn.
Yeah, yeah.
And sort of like, and they didn't really talk about that too much. That was Wes Craven. You've got Candyman, who's like haunting this white lady, and then you've got Vampire in Brooklyn, where Eddie Murphy's like, it's very much in a black world, like he's pursuing
Angela Bassett.
Yes. Yeah. And there's Kadeem Harrison as his like ghoul sidekick, and it's just this interesting, like, it's a different. I recently rewatched that movie like about a year ago, and I thought about that because, you know, Cabrini Green, you're showing an urban ghetto, really. I mean, you're showing a black experience that frankly is stereotypical, because people think, oh well, you know, black people live in these horrible neighborhoods. And A Vampire in Brooklyn, you know, you're seeing like up and coming well off black people in Brooklyn before the gentrification sweeps in. But it's just like Blackula, like this vampire is coming in, he's got money, he's got class, he's suave, you know. And just sort of like the differences between the two movies, and I thought it was interesting they didn't talk more about A Vampire in Brooklyn. The black presence in these horror movies in the 90s is, you know, for what it's worth, is pretty strong by that point. So I feel like Vampire in Brooklyn isn't so much a trendsetter as so much of like a beneficiary of what's come before. And it kind of takes you back to that 70s motif of like, you know, this is a black community. It's, I don't know, just made me think of that just now.
Yeah. And then when we also look at the 90s to the 2000s, you have lots of rappers and musicians in horror, like Aaliyah, LL Cool J, Ice Cube, Snoop. What do you guys think about... What are you laughing at? What am I doing?
No, you're fine. My very first thought is that Aaliyah in Queen of the Damned, terrible. First off, she was dead. I think it was her brother who did like the movements, and then, or something. They did some motion capture thing to, but I mean, it's not a good movie. And she's in it. I don't remember exactly, but it could have been because of her unfortunate passing at the time. But she's not even the focus of the movie. I mean,
no.
Like, the movie's called
like
Queen of the Damned,
and it's really about Stuart Townsend, not her.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so
when Akasha is the focus of the book. Anyway.
So I thought it was interesting. I mean, it's sort of like a nod to that because she was there, but it just sort of struck me as like a almost an odd inclusion to even mention because of like how terrible the movie is.
Yeah.
And how little she really is in it. And I think maybe they had a plan for a bigger role for her had she not, you know, died in a plane crash. Yeah. But it just sort of struck me as odd. And then I thought about these other movies. And
to remember, LL Cool J, he was in
Deep
Halloween,
Blue Sea.
H2O.
Deep Blue Sea and Halloween H2O.
Yeah.
And then there was Busta Rhymes in Halloween Resurrection.
That's
which
right.
Was just
That's
an,
right.
Which is an unwatchable travesty of a movie. But H2O is fun.
It is. But
I remember seeing Deep Blue Sea. And I think
I just think of that song from that movie.
is it LL Cool J? Like, he survives.
I think so.
It's been a Samuel while. L. Jackson who gets eaten by the shark. And that's a movie where they play on those, you know, they make fun of the trope. So he's standing there and you're like, you're thinking, oh, it's, you know, he's a famous actor. He's clearly going to make it.
And you know, he's giving this big hero speech.
Right.
And then sharked.
Whereas it's L. Cool J's character who's kind of like, if I remember correctly, like not like incompetent or anything like that. Just sort of like, here's Sammy J. He's the, you know, chief scientist or whatever, or leader of the military, something like he's some kind of guy in authority, an authority figure. And LL Cool J is like, just like the janitor or like, you know, someone who just happened to be there and all this stuff happens, but he survives by luck. And like, you know, just sort of being, you know, street smart or whatever it was that happened. I remember that being like, huh, this movie's kind of different. I didn't like think it was the best movie ever, but the fact that A, you had like a well-known actor, albeit black, get killed off like halfway through the movie at, you know, right when you think he's going to do something cool. Yeah. And then this other guy, like LL Cool J, I think that was one of his first like movie roles. Like you said, like where he got into a movie and it's like, hey, he actually makes it through when you thought for sure, oh, well, he's just some rapper, you know, he's going to get, he's the cannon fodder. He's definitely going to get his SAG credit, and he's the one who should get eaten by a shark. You don't think Sammy J is going to do it. And then you're like, I appreciated that when it happened, the play. But at that point, it also says that we've gotten enough representation that you can have two black actors in a horror movie. Yeah. And well, that we care more. You were thinking more about how successful this character is or the actor is. And that's going to keep him alive versus the, oh, by default, he's black, he's going to get killed.
Mm-hmm. Again, I'm going to point back to Nightmare on Elm Street Part 3, where, you know, you had the guy who was in the documentary, and you also had Larry Fishburne there.
That's true. That's true. I forgot.
Everything goes back to Nightmare on Elm Street Part
3. That was really
Dream
a
Warriors.
Yes. That was my favorite of the
That
Nightmare
was my favorite,
Street.
Too.
Yeah,
by far.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? I think both the black guys survived that movie.
I mean, as far as we know, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
I mean, now, of course, in the next movie, but...
Yeah, well, we're not talking about that right now. So instead, let's talk about the 2000s, which they characterize in the film as mostly being the period when you start to see people exposing cliches and stereotypes. The major example that they spend a lot of time in the film talking about is Get Out. And my question is, do you feel that the 2000s really could be characterized that way based on the films that you've seen coming out?
One of my first thoughts is that the 2000s, the late 90s, early 2000s gave us Scream. And I think I only saw like the first Scream movie, but suddenly like here are black characters who have a fighting chance and aren't just cannon fodder. But then like it made me think about Scary Movie, where they you know, you've got black characters front and center in the ensemble, but you're trying to turn all these tropes on its head and you're making fun of all these relations. At least that's how I remember it. Looking back, suddenly the people that you thought in the 80s and 90s weren't going to make it, they're making it. Like, it's these other characters that you start worrying about. Like, everyone's fair game now. Like, sort of like how Cabin in the Woods, which is not one of these movies, but it's sort of like everyone in that movie was fair game. Like, the people you think, oh, you look and you go, oh, there's a Hemsworth, he's making it. Oh, no, he doesn't.
No.
And like I said, like, when you get to the 2000s, and Pitch Black's really more of like an action film, but, you know, in the same vein as like Alien, where you've got people being eaten by alien space monsters, you don't think that, when you look at the cast, and you don't think it's going to be like the black Muslim guy, the bald, you know, something color guy, and the little girl who makes it. You think, okay, probably the girl, because they usually don't kill kids in movies. But, I mean, usually, like, these other guys are cannon fodder. It's like, kind of like, wait a minute, they're going to make it to the end of the movie? Really? Like, but I think we get used to exposing the cliches. And then is that in itself a cliche? Which is why I think Get Out was such a good movie, because you're watching it and you're you're expecting to see some cliches exposed, but you're not expecting to see the movie it turns out to be, like the way he tells the story and the way the horror is shaped. It's like, okay, this is really different. And that's what makes it frightening. Like
the fact that it's both commenting throughout on history, on microaggressions towards Black people, and it's also talking about cliches and stereotypes, and it's talking about so many tropes in horror all simultaneously while being legitimately scary and unsettling in every way. And I did like that they brought up the idea that the sunken place was meant to represent kind of a darkened theater, that it's the idea of, you know, not seeing yourself represented on the screen, or rather the way you are seeing yourself represented on the screen that's so terrifying. I thought that was an interesting point that was brought up in horror noir about that.
Get Out, of course, is fantastic. Us, I personally liked even better.
Yeah, I do too. I actually appreciate Us more deeply because it is so highly metaphorical.
Growing up as a Black person, you're sort of taught to, like, you know, remember where you are. How are you going to carry yourself? Like, if I'm with a lot of Black people, I'm not going to act the same way necessarily, you know, depending on who I'm dealing with, than I would in a room full of white people. But I think now when you think about the present time, and, like, you know, if I'm in a room full of people that I think of as allies, that's one situation that, you know, like, maybe very comfortable. But, you know, if you go someplace and suddenly you're in a room full of people you don't know and you don't really know their background, and sometimes you're fine. Other times you find that you're very surprised. And for me, watching that movie, you know, being the Black person taken to, like, you know, my husband's white, like, meeting his parents for the first time, like, you show up, he didn't tell his parents that he was dating a Black girl. So, like, and my in-laws are great, but I remember that first moment. We're at their house, and we haven't run into them yet. Like, we get to their house, we go inside, we're like, you know, we're looking around. And then Ben's dad walks in, and he just stops and does a double take. And the first thing out of his dad's mouth is, "Oh, you're pretty." And I'm thinking, like, what were you really thinking? I mean, my in-laws are great. They're very liberal. They're very open and friendly people. But for the main character walking into that house with his white girlfriend, given the history of how Black men are portrayed and horror movies in the media, it just sort of, like, it really strikes home for me, where it's like, okay, what's going to happen to this guy? Like, you know, it's a horror movie. Mm-hmm. He's going into this situation where he is the singular Black person at a weekend at a wealthy white family's house. What is going to happen to him? And so it's just, and it's not even just, like, the fact that they're, like, crazy body snatcher people, but all the other things that could happen to him. Mm-hmm. That to me is, like, the genius of the film, is that Jordan Peele could have made a movie of just all the horrible things that those people could have done to him that weren't horror movie things. That's what really makes it scary, that he's there, and you, because, like I said, you know what you signed up for when you walk into the theater. And he's there, and now, okay, what is going to happen to this character? And I think that the people discussing it in the documentary, when they talk about the ending, where, like, you know, you have the sheriff that shows up, and then, you know, like, you're like, oh God, is he going to be killed by the police? Because, again, that's a horror that Black people fear and experience. You know, the police,
as we see nowadays.
Right. And, like, the police aren't there to help you.
Yeah.
And that, you know, like you're watching as a Black person, you go, oh God, like, he's not going to make it out of this movie, just like in Night of the Living Dead. The police are going to show up, they're going to shoot him, and this is going to be a sad allegory. And instead, it's his friend in the airport car, and you're just like, yes, thank fucking God. he's getting out of this movie. Like,
yeah, and it's interesting that, you know, in the, I think it was Peele himself in the documentary who said that originally it was going to be sort of the Night of the Living Dead ending. But then he, you know, listened to the audiences and, you know, wanted to give them that cheer at the end. So, yeah.
Yeah.
We definitely cheered when we saw it. Because it's just like, again, like, you always know, like, it's hard to explain the feeling, like, but you feel like, you know, oh, I know where this is going. Like, every time you open up a news article and you see black person, you know, you're like, yeah. Oh no, I know where this is going, you know, like, to like, it's almost like sad, like, it's a horror movie to have a win, like, hey, like, he's going to make it, he's gonna walk away from the situation.
No, I had the exact same feeling when I saw those lights. I was like, oh god, this is I don't want to watch this. And then, you know, like, I remember, like, everyone in the audience, like, cheering loudly at that ending. And, you know, it was just so incredible that he was able to create that tension, that suspense, and then also that release for the audience.
Yeah, but I do find it interesting how, you know, me and Ariel both, you know, prefer the movie Us, while Alex prefers Get Out. And I could see how Get Out would, you know, speak to a black person. Because if you can't tell, I'm, like, so white, I'm basically transparent. But I could see how Get Out would definitely speak to a black person more than it would to, say, me. That doesn't mean I didn't like Get Out. I absolutely love that movie. It's fantastic. It gives that really, it really gives you an idea of what the black experience might be like if you've never had those sorts of experiences. You could see that on the screen where all this is coming from. But for somebody who has had those experiences, you could definitely see how this movie would really speak to them.
From the black experience, that, I mean, obviously watching him kill a whole bunch of white people, kind of cathartic. Not like, you know, to see him have those small victories where he's able to fight his way out. Like, it's like, you're watching it and you're just thinking, oh no, he's done. Oh man, like, he's not going to make it. Oh yes, he got away from this part. Oh, and there's this part. And like, it's sort of watching him knock down over and over each of the horrible things, like, you know, like the mom, the dad, you know, and then, like, you know, when the girlfriend, he thinks, oh, she's going to be helping me. She's my girlfriend. And she goes, oh, you know, I'm going to need those keys, babe. And he's like, oh, right. That's where your real loyalties are. But to see him be able to fight his way out, I felt like it's cathartic, because, you know, often you don't feel like you can fight. Like, you have to hold your tongue. You have to keep your feelings in check. You have to keep it behind, keep it inside, and you're not allowed to fight back. And so to see him be able to fight back and ultimately get away, like, he's not taken down by the police, like, he fights back and he gets to walk away.
Yeah.
That felt good, like, you know, to watch a movie like that.
Yeah, and it's great to see Jordan Peele putting this kind of work out there that bears out these kinds of discussions.
And I'm definitely looking forward to what he's done with Candyman, whenever that.
So, one thing I kind of wanted to talk about was, what are the themes and ideas that you guys felt were missing in this exploration of black horror? A lot of it was kind of based on specific eras within black horror, but were there any particular pieces that you wanted to see discussed that were not?
Well, way back at the beginning, in the early eras, they were, you know, talking about types of roles that black people would have, where they were mostly servants or comedic buffoons. And one actor that they specifically mentioned was a fellow named Mantan Moreland. Mm-hmm. Now, I would have liked to have had more of a discussion of that and of him in particular. I mean, yeah, he definitely played that sort of very stereotypical servant character. I remember things like King of the Zombies, for example. But he's also an interesting person when you get into him as a vaudeville comedian, him getting a lot of roles and those very mainstream roles, even if they are as this sort of comedic buffoon servant type character. At some point, he was almost invited to replace Shemp in the Three Stooges because Moe was a big fan of his.
Hmm.
But when you look at his legacy, it can be very complex. Because on the one hand, yes, he played all those stereotypical servant characters. And so he really fell out of favor when you start getting into, you know, the civil rights era and you look at the types of characters he was playing. And so he was assessed pretty poorly by that point.
Yeah, and especially when you look at Spider Baby and he's still playing
that sort of trope. Yeah.
Yeah.
But he was also, you know, somebody who was in these major movies. And in King of the Zombies, he has an extremely huge screen presence. Like, he could be kind of seen as the main character of that movie, which, if you think about it, in 1941, that's pretty impressive for a movie targeted toward white audiences. So I think that they throw his name in there kind of dismissively. They don't even show, you know, a clip of the guy. I would have liked to have seen a bit more discussion of the complexities of that sort of character, especially when they go into the Blaxploitation era. And you also have a lot of sometimes very negative stereotype characters in those movies as well.
Mm-hmm. But they do spend more time with them in the 70s than they do.
Yeah. So it seems kind of, you know, wrong to me to dismiss that this one type of actor, but sort of, you know, go into a lot of detail with this other type. So, but that's something I would have liked to see more of, I think.
I find often with documentaries that they're led by the footage they have.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if the first person you mentioned, if there just isn't a ton of footage of him or any good interviews to really lean on. But also, you know, they've got the message that they want to send.
Yeah.
So they're not going to talk about someone if they think that person is, you know, deleterious to their argument. Mm-hmm. But one of the clips they talked about was The Shining.
Mm-hmm.
It's Scatman Carruthers. And I thought that was a very interesting point that they made about, you know, in the book.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
He's got The Shining. He in the movie, he takes an axe to the chest and he's out, you know. And I remember when they remade The Shining movie, you know, I think they made a Sci-Fi Channel did a miniseries or the network did. And I think the same character survives, you know, obviously, like in the book. But that was an interesting point too, because, you know, Scatman Carruthers in and of himself is an interesting personality. You know, he had a very distinct voice, a lot of voice acting, but I feel like I don't think he had like that sort of like comedic history in the same way, but I feel like his voice alone is a product of a different time, and you just don't hear that voice anymore. Like, he's like a distinct kind of, he has a distinct way of speaking and talking, and like perfect for the 70s and The Shining. And like, yes, that's a black guy who came up. He could have played Uncle Ben or something, you know, but now you would not have that kind of character.
Yeah. Sean, since you are the resident zombie expert, having presented at panels on zombies, I have been your assistant once, but I bow to the master. I want to ask, how how do you feel zombies and voodoo have been portrayed historically? I don't feel like they discussed this at all. I think maybe because it's such a problematic topic in the history of Black horror.
Voodoo zombies are very different from what we think of zombies now. Like, when you go to Night of the Living Dead, they weren't even referred to as zombies by George Romero ever. That term was applied by, who was it, John Russo, who was also, you know, the co-writer of that movie. Generally, they were people who were, you know, sort of magically hypnotized. And going back through these movies, looking at some of the big ones, like, you know, White Zombie, you have Bela Lugosi as a voodoo master who's helping a plantation owner turn a woman into a zombie to steal her from her husband. You have King of the Zombies, where you have a Nazi spy who's using voodoo to extract secrets from the captured U.S. admiral. You have I Walked with a Zombie, where, you know,
they kept showing clips from I Walked with a Zombie, yeah, by the way, but they never actually mention it by name.
But, you know, here you know, it turns out that you have, you know, a mother, again, a white person, who goes to a voodoo priest to put somebody under a, you know, her son's wife under a voodoo curse. You have zombies on Broadway, again, Bela Lugosi as the mad scientist using magic to create zombies. So, yeah, you know, then you get the later movies where, you know, you have Scream, Blackula Scream, where you have Pam Grier as the person who's, you know, has the voodoo magic power and is going to try to use this voodoo magic to free Blackula from his curse. And you have Sugar Hill, where you have, you know, the black woman who is using voodoo to get revenge on the person who murdered her lover, and who's, you know, these people who she's getting revenge on are doing a lot of horrible things. So you could see that in the right hands, voodoo can be a force for good. But in the wrong hands, or should I say the white hands, voodoo can be a source of great evil.
Yeah. And it's very interesting, too, when you think about the Haitian roots, a specific film that kind of reclaims this history that's pretty recent called Zombie Child, that I really love, by Bertrand Bonello, who is a French filmmaker who looks at the history of Haiti and French colonialism and tries to put it in the terms of the concept that the zombie was created as a response to French colonialism, that you wanted to kind of tune out of your own experience as a slave in the fields. You wanted to be nothing but an empty vessel. And so you became a zombie under those terms. And so it's a very interesting exploration of what the zombie trope means. But then it also is what I would call more horror adjacent than an actual horror movie, because it's so highly intellectual and spends a lot of time, like, literally giving you a lecture about French colonialism.
Yep.
So I don't know. Like, how did you feel about that film, Sean?
Well, I just watched it last night, and I'm going to be honest with you.
You hated it?
No, I liked it. It's just that I've, you know, had been having this bad headache the last week.
Yeah.
So I probably didn't get as much out of it as I should have. Mm. But, you know, when it does start getting into the more horror-esque portions near the end of the movie, I got a lot more into it.
Yeah.
When it's giving you a lecture on French colonialism earlier on, I might have started tuning it out a bit. But I thought I liked it quite a bit.
Yeah. I mean, what's important to me is that you have this one female Black character who's surrounded by all these white girls mm-hmm. at this elite boarding school. And so she has this sort of singular experience, and she's regarded as being like
weird.
the person who is weird, the person yeah. who, you know, we can, you know, interrogate about, you know, what her weirdness is, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And then
that's a, yeah. I was going to say, I haven't seen this movie, but having been like the one in settings like that, yeah, you end up being like the ambassador of Blackness, or, you know,
yeah,
and people always like, oh, what about this? Or, you know, can I ask you that? Can I touch your hair? Like, or, you know, you do this, right? You know, like, yes, we have rap battles at my house every night. And,
you know someone who does voodoo, right?
I definitely.
Yeah, you know, totally.
Third Tuesday, we do voodoo down at the Voodoo Center.
Right.
And, you know, those kind of things, like, they just, people expect you to just know, like, oh, yeah. And, like, I think you're mentioning this movie and the fact that it's about the French colonial experience reminds people should be reminded that Black culture is not a monolith. Like, there's a Black diaspora that there's, you know, like, candomblé, there's voodoo, and, you know, like, I'm a Black American whose family is from, like, upstate New York and Georgia and Ohio, and yeah, like, as far as I know, we have nothing absolutely to do with voodoo ever. Like, you know, it's just not part of our culture. So it's just as exotic to me. So, like, if someone came to me and asked me about voodoo, I'm like, I don't know. Like, it's just as exotic and foreign to me. Like, you know, but I think as a Black person and growing up and watching those types of movies, the way it was portrayed to me is like, hey, look, and the way I took it from, like, Sugar Hill in particular when I saw those clips is like, this is a way Black people can access power in these types of environment. Like Shani's got a very good point. This is how the Black characters have power in their environment, but it still also makes them the other, because there's no white voodoo or, you know, equivalent in these settings. But it's like, hey, I can embrace this power that, you know, in some settings is this very much a Black thing that I can go out and use to help my community. And in other settings, it's this power that comes in that I can have and is mysterious and exotic. It's just like, you know, how Asians are portrayed as like the dragon women and kung fu masters and that kind of thing. And I guess for Black people in some of these settings, it's voodoo.
Yeah. Now, Alex, I want to ask you, like, what representations of Black horror have impressed you in recent years that we haven't talked about already?
Let's see. I noticed, like, in your notes, you have mentioned The Girl with All the Gifts.
Yeah.
And
have you seen that?
I've read the book. I've seen the movie. We recently watched the movie during our time home and for COVID. And I'd read the book a few years ago before the movie came out. And I agree with the documentary that in the, it was one point they didn't bring up was that in the book, the teacher character, she is Black and she's an immigrant to the UK. So she was representing the Black UK immigrant experience, which I thought was sort of an interesting way to look at it. The fact that society at the end of the movie, the book, collapses, and now it's this Black woman who is imparting the knowledge of humanity to these zombie children.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely agree with the decision to cast a, you know, when they found this Black child actress and she did a great job. I think it was a really good move to cast her. They didn't really point out that there was always some intent to have that sort of acknowledgement of racial issues. Mm-hmm. And we're Americans. We're not, you know, the UK's racial issues are different. It comes up a bit in Attack the Block too, but it was just interesting to sort of see how they took that. And by making the zombie girl, Melanie, Black, and then making the teachers white, you know, you're saying, like, you're showing who is now inheriting the earth, which mm-hmm. is kind of, it was an interesting way to go about it. And I thought that was pretty well done. Like, one that does come to mind, which is not specifically a black horror movie, but has a black character in it, though, that I thought was interesting was 28 Days Later.
Mm-hmm. Naomi Harris's performance.
And I think, just again, that's another British film.
Mm-hmm.
And so sort of like the thinking and the, you know, how people are reflected in that story and just sort of, yeah, I thought that one was really well done. It's like I said, it's not necessarily about the black experience or black people, but the fact that she's there
mm-hmm.
and she survives. And
that it doesn't always have to be explicitly about race, that you can right. have a black character just because there are black people in the world, and let's acknowledge that fact.
Exactly. And there's that scene in 28 Days Later where the military commander, when they think, you know, like Jim and Naomi Harris's character and the girl, they think, oh, we're saved. Like, we found the military. They're the ones that have lost their humanity. Like, they're chaining up people. They've got these young girls and they're thinking, oh, right, great. We've got comfort women now. Perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So humanity saved. And it just, those ideas, which yeah. I thought were interesting.
Yeah. And that line that Senia Nanua has in The Girl with All the Gifts, you know, toward the end of the movie when she says, why should it be us who die for you? I right. think has particular resonance because they're coming from the mouth of a young black girl. And I find that film so incredibly powerful for that reason. You know, when she's saying that to Glenn Close, who is like, you know, I mean, there are so many things that that line represents to me, but it really demonstrates to me how really we've been thinking about everything wrong all along, and as the characters have in the movie, and it makes you realize that the entire system of oppression and institutionalization, as it has been set up, both in this fantastic world as well as in the real world, have been pretty fucked up. So yeah, that's my thought.
Yeah, I also, the other thing I was thinking about too with that movie is that when she's hurting the other zombie children,
mm-hmm.
how like she's like the only one of color, or one of the very few of color that you yeah. see, and sort of yeah. like, okay, and I just remember seeing the part where she's using these like guttural sounds and like physical violence to keep them in line. And I wondered, I was like, well, you know, what are they trying to say here at this moment? And, you know, like just the idea, like she's got these primal urges. And I was like, but I don't think they're trying to say, oh, like, you know, black people have these primal urges. They're not civilized, right, but right. just sort of like, taking it in, like, that she has those internal struggles.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like often you don't see characters of color get those types of struggles on screen.
Right. And I think that's an important point, that you don't see that internal conflict, or it's sublimated in some way or coded so that you don't necessarily recognize it for what it is.
But you also have it where she's clearly very strong and she's mm-hmm. ripped people to pieces. And that goes back to that earlier thought of like, you know, the toughest person in the room. Yeah. This horror creature has beat the black guy. But, you know, in this one, it's this little girl who is the the strongest and the protector. And
yeah,
I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, me too. So what about you, Sean?
So can't comment.
Yeah, but what about you? So you saw Zombie Child. Have there been any other films that we haven't mentioned that are favorites recently?
I mean, things that came out recently. The only one that really sticks in my mind is Us, which we've, you know, mentioned and talked about. So I guess I'll just call back to, you know, the movie that I kind of discovered through this documentary, which was Blackula.
Okay.
I'm just going to say.
New to you.
Yeah, new to me. Yeah. If you haven't watched Blackula or have, you know, dismissed it like I did because it's called Blackula, watch it. It's a fantastic movie.
Okay. Well, those are excellent, excellent words to end on. But what I'd like to do right now is if you could quickly tell how people can encounter the great projects you guys are working on.
All right. Well, I run a podcast called Doctor Who's That. So if you're a Doctor Who fan, check it out. Basically, I am taking somebody who has never watched Doctor Who, and I'm making him watch it starting from the very beginning in 1963 in chronological order. So we'll see how this crazy experiment goes. But yeah, you could look for me on Doctor Who's That.
Okay. And I think your Twitter is
DR_who's_that.
Okay.
I almost don't even know what a podcast is. Like, are you stealing my soul? I'm not really sure.
I might be.
No, I know what podcasts are. Like, I've listened to a few, but like, yeah, I just, you know, I don't really get out much, especially with kids. So I don't really have any like projects out there that people can find. I mean, if somebody really wants to talk to me, they can email you, I guess, and maybe I'll. I'm pretty friendly if you talk to me, but yeah, otherwise I'm kind of like a.
Okay.
I'm a house hermit.
Okay. Well, Alex is going to be back for conversations about N.K. Jemisin and Octavia Butler later. So she is going to be a podcast queen. We will make her one. We will. So we are at Omnibus Ride at all the social medias. Please like and follow us if you can on Instagram and Twitter if you'd like. Thanks so much for writing the omnibus today, and thank you guys so much for sharing all your thoughts and opinions on these wonderful works. I learned so much from both of you in terms of your experiences, both watching these films and living through all the stuff and things.
Yeah, well, thank you for having us on here.
Yeah. It's been fun. So thanks for writing the omnibus. And don't forget to tune in for our next conversation on Tales from the Hood, a modern masterwork of horror. Please take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes or Podchaser. Comments from listeners help us to grow, and every like or share is a signal boost we need to keep our content going strong. Thanks, guys.